This week in the news, we'll talk to Aaron Anderson, our electoral zombie hunter, and we'll also chat with Brandon Waltons about how one of the governor's top backers is supporting liberal Democrats. In this week's interview, we talked to Michael Voris of churchmilitant.com about a matter of concern not only to conservative Catholics, but really to all pro-life Texans. And we'll end with a commentary from Ross Kessig on why we should all be inspired to persevere. Welcome back, friends and neighbors, to Texas Scorecard Radio. I'm your host, Tony McDonald, coming to you from the 1836 studios. Let's get started. First up in the news this week, I wanted to talk to Aaron Anderson with Texas Scorecard. You're kind of our resident electoral zombie hunter, and up with a story about dead people voting in South Texas. Tell us about the rising of the dead to the polls.
Well, that's right, Tony. Recently, it was uncovered that a former judge in Starr County, Texas, who had died in 2010, had been continuing to vote three times since he died. And, of course, it wasn't really that deceased person that's voting. What we're finding is that people are continuing to vote in the names of deceased people because their names stay on the voter rolls.
Yeah, I mean, so we're talking about a lot of mail-in ballot fraud here. And problems with the voter rolls. This isn't unique to South Texas. You know, I think a lot of us sometimes go, oh, well, you know, South Texas, there's all kind of things that go on down there. There's reason to believe that there's stuff going on in a lot of other places, right?
That's right, Tony. This particular case was uncovered because there is a federal lawsuit going on in Starr County that is challenging their voter roll maintenance there in the county, finding more people on the voter rolls than there are people alive and eligible to vote.
So you actually have a voter roll, a list of registered voters, and we know not everyone registers to vote, and there's children and everything else, but you're talking about a total number of people registered to vote that's greater than the number of people who even live in the county.
That's right, and that's a pretty good tip, that the voter rolls are not being maintained properly.
Right.
And the reason that this goes on, we found out at a hearing last month that a Senate Committee on Election Security held, is that there really is no state oversight of county voter registration officials. And it's up to private citizens and private organizations, like we have here in Starr County, Public Interest Legal and American Civil Rights Union, to monitor these voter rolls and, if necessary, sue in federal court to get voter registrars to comply with the law and keep clean voter lists.
Yeah, now there's a couple of things you touched on in your article up at Texas Scorecard is two things. One, the state is kind of saying, hey, look, this is a hands-off thing. We, you know, this isn't our job. They ask us to help, we'll help, but it's not our job to make sure that these roles are kept in place. And then also that we have these groups that are kind of calling out these counties for having, you know, bad voter rolls, all these people who are ineligible or dead or, you know, what have you on the rolls, they're starting to look at bigger counties.
That's right. I think there's a public perception that the state and the secretaries of state's office is overseeing what's going on in the counties. And in fact, the way our system is set up, it's a county-based system. Each county is responsible for their own elections and maintaining their own voter rolls. And there's really not anything in our current law that lets state officials oversee or enforce those clean voter rolls.
And so that basically means you've got to have these citizen groups who are stepping in to do the oversight role that, you know, we all think, look, you know, some magical guy in Austin is going to, you know, look at all the results and make sure that everything's calibrated and correct. And what we learn is it just, that isn't how government actually works. It works, if it works, whenever the people get involved at the local level.
That's right. And fortunately, there's a federal law, the National Voter Registration Act, that lets private individuals and groups sue county officials if they're not doing their job. Public Interest Legal is actually doing this all over the country. They're involved in the Starr County case, but they're also put two big counties on notice Bexar County and Harris County, that they are in potential violation of the NVRA. They're not allowing access to their voter rolls so that this group can see what is actually going on and if their voter rolls are clean. And it's pretty well known that there are a lot of non-citizens registered and voting in counties across Texas, including Bexar and Harris. And the Texas Attorney General's office did a quick look-see and found that very same thing is happening.
Yeah. Well, I think this is just barely scratching the surface. I'm excited to read more of what you write about this because, you know, we're talking about Bexar, San Antonio, you know, and Harris, Houston. I mean, some of these biggest counties in the state that are going to be next to be under the microscope. And I think people are not going to be happy with what they see, but they will be happy with what they get to read from you. So thank you.
thank you for covering it
and joining us today.
You bet.
Now let's talk to Brandon Walton's Capital Bureau Chief with Texas Scorecard. Governor Abbott's campaign treasurer kind of drawing some heat over some things he's involved in, kind of out of step a little bit with the governor.
Yeah, so a little bit of background here. Democrat Congressman Gene Green in the Houston area, retiring this year. State Senator Sylvia Garcia won the Democrat primary, so she's going to be moving out of the Senate and going to be likely filling that seat in Congress. Opens up a Democrat state Senate seat in the Houston area.
Kind of a musical chairs thing.
Exactly.
You know, one person moves here, and then another one moves there, and then all of a sudden there's this race down the ballot that becomes the big hot thing.
Exactly. And so you've got a couple of Democrat state reps in Houston running for that state Senate seat that's opened up. And State Representative Carol Alvarado, liberal Democrat down there from the Houston, Pasadena area, announced a list of endorsements, including a lot of, you know, big liberal names, Mayor Anise Parker, the former mayor of Houston, and you know, other state representatives, Democrats in the Houston area. Also on the list is John Now.
Yeah, and this stands out. John Now is
the campaign treasurer for Governor Abbott's campaign.
Yeah, and so kind of a surprise. Obviously, Governor Abbott runs a conservative campaign, a conservative platform, done a lot of conservative things, called for a lot of conservative policy reforms as governor, and his biggest financial backer is backing this liberal Democrat.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about who John Now is.
So John Now is the president and CEO of Silver Eagle Distributors. This is the largest Anheuser-Busch beer distributor in the country, and so very tied with big beer and a lot of the politics behind that. We saw some of this during the last session when
an issue we could spend a whole interview. We may have to do that at some point, do a whole interview on the program on that. But yeah, there's so much politics involved with these kind of fiefdoms in the beer industry that have existed for decades, and then all of these upstart new creators in the craft beer industry kind of cutting into that industry.
Exactly.
And now's on the kind of establishment side of that. But very interesting. This is not the first time that Now has kind of been out of step with the governor.
No, and so when Governor Abbott took the extraordinary step of endorsing conservatives against some of the liberal establishment Republicans in the House, and Now was out of step with him there. He endorsed Sarah Davis, who's, of course, the most liberal Republican in the House.
Yeah, the only pro-abortion Republican, openly pro-abortion Republican
in the
House. Yes, and
sent money to State Representative Wayne Faircloth, who, of course, went on to be defeated by conservative challenger Mays Middleton.
Yeah, and so you had the governor kind of doing this rather extraordinary thing of saying, look, we're going to go out here and get rid of some of these, or try to get rid of some of these bad Republicans in the Republican primary. And his campaign treasurer, is his top financial guy on his campaign, is out there saying, well, then, you know, I'm going to endorse opposite the governor on these things. And now, of course, endorsing the liberal Democrat for the Senate.
Exactly. And making a lot of conservatives watching, you know, wondering how committed he is to Governor Abbott's conservative agenda.
Yeah, I think it's something we'll have to continue to keep an eye on. Appreciate your reporting on it, Brandon. And thanks for telling us about it today.
Thank you.
Texas Scorecard Radio is a project of Empower Texans. At texasscorecard.com or empowertexans.com, you can find more news and daily updates from all around the Lone Star State. You can also find updates from Empower Texans and Texas Scorecard on Facebook and Twitter, and follow Empower Texans on Instagram. Texas Scorecard's news digest goes out weekly via email and monthly in print. Subscribe online and find more information at empowertexans.com. Someone's always keeping score. We think it ought to be the taxpayers.
Well, it's a pleasure to welcome on the program this week Michael Voris with churchmilitant.com. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much, Tony. Good to be here.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to have you on to talk about specifically the conflict in the pro-life movement in Texas and how that relates, how that's of relevance and very important to Catholics and some developments there. But more generally, you know, there is this need for conservative Texans, specifically conservative Catholics, to be on alert against the infiltration of the church by certain liberal agendas.
No, absolutely. Look, this goes back decades and decades and decades. There just wasn't a social media presence to be able to report on it. And since the left had infiltrated the church and sort of grabbed hold, seized hold of all of the organs of communication, they prevented the message from getting out. But, you know, now here's this wonderful thing called the internet and social media, and there is now a legitimate rival to the left's control of the message inside the Catholic Church, as well as out in the culture in general. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's kind of what we've seen with the conservative movement generally. You know, you see the rise of, you know, say, National Review, you know, back in the 50s. Well, now all of that's online, and there's lots of National Reviews and lots of voices who are talking about conservative things. And specifically, your website's focusing on these issues within the Catholic Church that are relevant to conservative Catholics.
Yeah, I mean, you will find among Catholics who are of a politically conservative bent also an accompanying theological orthodoxy.
Right.
They believe what the church teaches. They, you know, all of that. They adhere to those teachings. They go to Mass on Sundays and holy days. You know, they live their faith, they have a devotional life, say the rosary, all of these things that you would do as a good Catholic, you know, trying to become holy and get to heaven, in short. Well, their political views also generally tend to align with that very same thing. And you've got exceptions here and there, but they are the exception. So what is going on inside the church is an attempt to silence these kinds of Catholics, actually faithful Orthodox Catholics, by people who are claiming the mantle of Catholicism and yet flirting with the culture of death, accommodating it, not wanting to, you know, lose their standing in the political scene, in the cultural scene. They want to appear relevant. And, you know, so many of them will, for example, you know, cut corners, come up with accommodations, come up with a rationalization that, well, we have to sort of do things incrementally, not just for the case of abortion, but everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can't, I mean, you know, one bishop got on the air and said, in defiance of a directive from the Vatican, and this is a very well-respected bishop, his name is Bishop Robert Barron, he got on the air on a very popular online show and just said, well, I wouldn't recommend that, you know, the Catholics, you know, sort of campaign against same-sex marriage right now. Well, there is a directive from the Vatican that faithful Catholics must campaign against that whenever they have the opportunity to. Yet here's a bishop selling out again, and that's it. It's a sellout
of the Catholic
faith by the people who are either, you know, they're career-minded or they're lazy or they don't know the faith or they're just power-hungry and they want government money coming to them. I mean, check whatever boxes you want. That's what's going on.
Yeah, it's standing for truth when it's convenient, you know, which is basically when it's not really all that important. To do it is when it's convenient. Quickly, church militant. So I think some Christians might say militancy, you know, what does this mean? Tell us a little bit, what does that mean, you know, church militant?
Well, church militant is in favor of the execution. I'm joking. it has nothing to do with the violence or anything like that. It's a theological term that the church, many people, even our Catholic, will say the Apostles' Creed, and in there is the phrase, the communion of saints. That is a reference to the faithful who have died and are in heaven. That group is referred to as the church triumphant. They've won. Their salvation is secured. There they are in the presence of the Holy Trinity. Then another group is the church purgative or the church suffering. Those are souls who have died and been saved but are still expiating, paying the price for their temporal price for their sins here on earth, but they're in purgatory, but are on their way to heaven. And then there is the third component, which is the church militant, and the church militant is people here on Earth who are still fighting evil, generally speaking, evil within themselves, you know, desire for sin and that sort of thing. But also, sort of extemporaneous to that, they're also fighting the evil in the culture, you know, abortion, you know, Planned Parenthood, same-sex marriage. I mean, all the moral evil that threatens to engulf and corrupt their children and have them lose their souls.
And I think that's what a lot of us who are involved in following politics have come to realize, particularly through the fights over abortion, but it's not limited to that issue. You see this clear battle between good and evil. I mean, I think back a few years ago when the pro-life legislation was being moved through the Texas Capitol, and you had literally the opponents of it engaging in witchcraft in the dome. You know, they're out there chanting Hail Satan.
Yeah, we reported on that. I mean, that's exactly what it is. I mean, it is a, you know, and look, everything is ultimately, everything that may affect your eternal salvation or damnation, everything is a spiritual battle. I mean, great Catholic authors and saints and mystics and doctors and fathers of the church have written for 2,000 years on spiritual warfare, spiritual combat. And of course, this is what it is. I mean, if you're a follower of Jesus Christ, you believe that the devil wants you damned. You believe that there is a devil, you believe there's a hell, and you believe there's a way that you can be damned.
Right.
Matter of fact, there are many ways you could be damned.
Right.
But there's only one way to be saved.
Right.
So that's the level on which everybody has to operate theologically. That theological truth plays out in the temporal world in every sphere of life. What are the movies that are being made? I mean, here's, you know, three movies up for Oscar nominations that are all about sexual perversion.
Right.
You know, one of them about pederasty.
Right.
You know, you've got the horrible, immoral stuff going on in politics to advance people's personal careers at the expense of sacrificing the culture and thereby the children and grandchildren who, you know, if you think about it right now, anybody who's, you know, essentially 20 right now has grown up in a world, actually anybody who's 40, has grown up in a world here in the United States where abortion has just been accepted. And little children right now who are 6, 7, 8 years old are going to grow up in a world where abortion is completely legal and accepted. And so it's homosexuality, the same, you know, the two guys, two women getting married, and, you know, they're the same as their mom and dad.
Yeah.
And we know that's not true.
Yeah, right, right.
You have to fight this stuff. So, yeah, absolutely, that's a spiritual battle.
Well, and so but part of the problem is that you have, as we were mentioning earlier, this infiltration into the church by left-wing agendas that accommodate evil, that accommodate these horrible agendas. And one of those things we've seen boil over just during the primary over the last few weeks was a circular put out by the Texas Catholic Conference of Bishops basically condemning the strongest and oldest and largest pro-life organization in Texas, Texas Right to Life, for being too pro-life.
Yeah, I mean, we did an awful lot of reporting on that when we were down there covering the midterms, the primaries. It was stunning to me on so many levels when I read that. That first of all, it made it appear as though Texas Right to Life was claiming the mantle of speaking for the church. Texas Right to Life isn't a Catholic group. There are a lot of Catholics associated with
it,
even in leadership of it, but it's not a Catholic church group. So to sort of level that charge is immediately a red herring. And the bishops, or the woman who put that together for them, Jennifer Carr Allman, knows that. So, and this is one of the tactics the left uses all the time. They trump up a charge against you, which really isn't the charge, and then they damn you with that charge. And it has nothing to do with it. Texas Right to Life hasn't claimed to speak for the church. And the other thing that was really interesting in that is that they actually named two groups in that press release. Like, Texas Right to Life is horrible. Don't listen to them. But you should listen to Texas Alliance for Life and Texas Coalition for Life.
And these are two phony groups.
It's a document from the bishops. That gives at least the implication, and I think flat out says it to anybody who has a brain, that these groups do speak for the church. And that's a big problem, because those groups sanction and endorse on their slate of candidates people who, lawmakers, Byron Cook, for example, who go directly, diametrically opposed to Catholic Church teaching.
Yeah, who've worked against the pro.
How can the Catholic look at that and say, yeah, say this is a legitimate thing?
Yeah, these are groups that have endorsed and supported candidates in the Republican primary against pro-life, opponents. They have mm-hmm. supported these candidates who have, at times been openly outspoken in their support for abortion rights. And, in the case of Byron Cook, have been openly, they're speaking from the House floor saying, look, this is a choice that people ought to be allowed to make.
Yeah, they take money from Planned Parenthood for campaigns, and they accept awards from them, and, they work out sweetheart deals for them, for like low rent and buildings at the cities and, government agencies own.
Right.
How on earth could the bishops of Texas produce a document that says these people don't speak for the Catholic Church? Texas Right to Life has never claimed to speak for the Catholic Church, and yet these folks are fine. Go to there, and they put a link.
Yeah. What can Catholics in Texas be doing to fight back against this ridiculous charge that was put forth by the bishop and really by the staff, by Jennifer Allman?
Oh, well, I think they have to blow back loudly and hard. They need to get on the phones. They need to call their the chancery in whatever diocese they're in. They need to write letters to the bishop. They need to start online petitions. They need to make an uproar in Texas. Texas is the state, as you know.
Right.
Texas is the state where abortion came from. Wade was the district attorney, attorney general. And it would be poetic, divine justice, providential that, abortion could come to an end. We're at the same place it began. But in the meantime, until these internal battles are settled, none of that can happen. And this constant wishy-washy, squishy position of the bishops, and they have liberals, political liberals, and you got to say unorthodox Catholic, because there is no way a faithful Catholic is going to say, oh, we can vote for this guy, he's pro-abortion,
we
can just turn the other way, or we can accommodate him and not really talk about it. That's not a faithful Catholic position, and when you die, you will stand in front of the King of Kings, and you'll give an account for your cooperation. You didn't do it, but you helped it, and you have to give an account to that. You helped with the murder of babies. Maybe you didn't do it, but you certainly facilitated it in whatever way you did. That's not an orthodox Catholic position.
Right, right.
So they will accommodate these kinds of people and let them work in the chanceries and let them write documents and things to slander stuff and slander good people's names. But in this case, I have to say that they did this in writing, and then at least one bishop, well, as a matter of fact, at least two bishops, Vasquez in Austin and Olson in Fort Worth, directed their priests to then read that statement, or
this misleading
that statement,
this misleading
from the
statement.
Pulpit.
Yeah.
Wow. Very misleading statement.
Wow.
And
there's
a civil suit there. There's a tax exempt status issue there that I know is proceeding. I was just talking with some folks yesterday down in Texas. That is, they're crafting that, and the bishops have gone too far, or they've allowed their staff that they're also responsible for to go too far here. In promoting
something that's just straight up dishonest. So I think we're out of time, but thank you for being in the fight. I mean, I appreciate everything you're doing to bring up, put a spotlight on these things. Tell people where they can learn more about churchmilitant.com, how they can see more of your work.
Yeah, well, thanks for the shameless plug opportunity. I just come to churchmilitant.com. We produce videos, articles, and everything every day. We're sort of a new part of us is a news information gathering production site. The other part is has a theological component to it, like 700-800 hours worth of theological programming in all sorts of formats, long form, short form, et cetera. And, it's all meant to say, hey, look, you need to live your life in conformity with everything that Jesus Christ taught, teach them, everything I have commanded you. And that's the only way to get to heaven. And this kind of soft selling garbage of, well, you can accommodate and rationalize. You can rationalize yourself right into hell. So that's why churchmilitant.com exists, to kind of shine a light on all the theological errors that are being put at the service of the left that has infiltrated the church.
Well, thanks for joining us, Michael, and appreciate you coming on.
Appreciate it very much, Tony. God bless, and God bless all your listeners.
In this week's commentary, Ross Kessig talks about the heroes of the Texas Revolution and why they should inspire us to persevere.
Washington on the Brazos is known as the birthplace of Texas because it was there that on March 1st, 1836, delegates met to announce Texas's separation from Mexico and to form a new republic. The next day, independence was declared officially, and by March 16th, a constitution was adopted. But there's a lesser-known story that's rarely told, and it's much darker than the one we remember from elementary school. With the Texas Scorecard radio commentary, I'm Ross Kessig. Texas fought for independence because the alternative was to live under a bloodthirsty dictatorship, whose military coup overthrew the rule of law, tormented its citizens, and executed dissidents. The year before Texians declared independence, Mexico's President Santa Anna replaced Mexico's constitution, dissolved its Congress, and centralized power. His regime morphed into a dictatorship and, with the military's backing, declared martial law in several Mexican states, including Tejas. Santa Anna launched a barbaric military campaign to murder Texian opposition to his regime. On March 17th, the day after Texas's founding fathers formed the new republic, Santa Anna's army marched towards Washington on the Brazos, forcing Texas's delegates to flee. But Texas's leaders weren't the only patriots on the run. Sam Houston had ordered the evacuation of Gonzales and dispatched couriers to warn residents across the region. Houston's retreat and his dispatched warning spurred Texians to literally abandon their homes in a frantic panic known as the Runaway Scrape. Texians weren't fleeing simply to avoid a run-in with the Mexican army. They fled because Santa Anna was executing everyone in his path. Along the way, Santa Anna also destroyed property and burned entire towns. During early skirmishes between Texian soldiers and the Mexican army, some Texian soldiers surrendered, believing they'd become prisoners of war. But Santa Anna showed no mercy, ordering their executions and desecrating the bodies. Santa Anna infamously executed the brave survivors at the Alamo. He also ordered the execution of more than 420 soldiers at Goliad, who had also surrendered, ignoring protests from his own commanders. Just like those at the Alamo, the Texians were lined up and shot, while wounded survivors were clubbed and knifed to death. The prisoners' bodies were piled and burned and left out in the open. The news of both the Alamo and the Goliad massacre instilled fear and resulted in the mass exodus of civilians across the territory. Added to the discomforts of the open wilderness were various diseases, intensified by cold, rain, and hunger. Exposed, malnourished, and ill-prepared, thousands of civilians died. The plight of our patriotic forefathers was bleak. Their struggle was between life and liberty, or death. And never, under such grim circumstances, was victory certain. Never did they imagine that less than a month after the new republic was formed and civilians were forced to flee their homes, that Santa Anna would be defeated. Little did they know that the nation they created would eventually become the world's 11th largest economy. Fortunately, today's Texans do not face the same threats overcome by our founders. Today, our fight is at the ballot box, not the battlefield. And while Texans may lose elections, our lives are not in jeopardy. We haven't been forced to flee our homes. While the battle is similar, the stakes are much smaller. The fight for limited government, lower taxes, and a freer society is a long and arduous cause, and it's one that never really ends. But it's a cause worth fighting for. The future of Texas's economic miracle depends upon our willingness to fight. And like our forefathers, you never know when victory is right around the corner.
Well, friends, that's all I have for you this week. Join us back here next week for another episode of Texas Scorecard Radio.
Texas Scorecard Radio is brought to you each week as a public service from the Empower Texans Foundation and in partnership with the Lincoln Institute and this station. You can download podcasts from each program and learn more at empowertexans.com.